because, like you're saying, if you had a 1 millihenry inductor between your transceiver and the battery source or wherever the power source is, and you were to square 10 amps, that's 100, and then 1 millihenry, you could see the amount of energy there. the Zener diode you'd need to try to protect something like that would have to look like the size of a Coke can. It's not going to work. So you really don't want to ever put a differential inductor in series with a transceiver in any case, especially when there's large current swings, and especially with amplifiers. If anything, let me let this drop for a second. Whenever I've done high-powered amplifiers or even with single sidebands in mobile operation, one of the things I've done is I've gone and gone to these audio, high-power audio stores where they'll sell these very, very large wiring kits and capacitors. They have these monster capacitors, like almost like 1 farad capacitor or 2 farads. They're monstrous. And you can put them right next to your amplifier in the car. And if you need to draw peak currents into your amplifier and filter right at the amplifier or, you know, a very, very large transceiver or something, that really flattens things out nicely. And there's no inductive kickbacks or any of those problems. But certainly to put that differential inductor in series with a transceiver, big, big, big mistake. As I think you've already pointed out, Dick. K2RIW, KC2, if you like to.
I like what you suggested, Glenn. Nowadays, you can buy these so-called super caps, where in some cases they're a rectangular package about 2 inches long, about an inch wide, and about a third of an inch high. And in there, they can put 1 farad at 12 volts and numbers like this. It's a fairly compact, very low impedance device with great big wide leads coming out of it. And you put that across the rig, and a lot of the glitches from your automobile are removed. One of the things that we forget about is that on a cold day, the cranking current going into your starter motor could easily be 200 amperes. At the instant you turn that key and close that solenoid at the starter motor, and 200 amperes is flowing through that wiring. No problem while the current is flowing. At the instant you turn off the starter motor, at 200 amperes drops to some very low number in a hurry. You got a lot of stored magnetic energy in the starter motor itself. You got a fair amount of stored magnetic energy in the wiring that goes to it. So the instantaneous voltage glitch that you could get on an automobile system when that starter motor is being turned on and turned off, although it's very brief, it could be a huge voltage. And again, these super caps will help you an awful lot. And by the way, when it comes to putting the Zener diode across the far end of a series inductor of my example, it's not quite as bad as you think, Glenn, because the current that it kicks back is never greater than the current that went into it. In my example, 20 amperes went into that inductor. The magic of an inductor is that you cannot instantaneously change the current on an inductor. The magic of a capacitor, an ideal capacitor, is you cannot instantaneously change the voltage on a capacitor. Let's go back to the inductor. If under working load, the inductor is drawing 20 amperes, and now your load goes to, in the worst case, 0 amperes, because the transmitter and the afterburner amplifier both get turned off, and 20 amperes of stored energy is in that inductor, the inductor is going to kick back. He wants to give you an infinite voltage if it was an open circuit. If you have a Zener diode there, the current on the Zener diode will be 20 amperes. As long as you've got a Zener diode beefy enough with a good heat sink on it, that the manufacturer tells you it will tolerate 20 amperes at 18 volts, and it can do it for 2 seconds, so to speak, then you're home free. So there are one single event type current ratings on things like Zener diode. So as long as your Zener can tolerate 20 amps for, let me pick a number, 1 second, and it's going to be an exponential decay, the real current that goes into the Zener, although it's got to be a beefy Zener, it is possible, but you got to be a little bit careful. You might have some comments on this one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Not really, Dick, other than, as I said, I think that still is going to be an extremely large Zener diode that, you know, for especially somebody out there trying to connect a transceiver up in a car application, to find that kind of Zener diode, it's not something they're going to find in Radio Shack or a typical place. As a matter of fact, I haven't really run across too many Zener diodes that you know, or, let's say if the voltage is 12 to 16, that's 4 volts, that's 20 amperes, that's 80 watts, but even for a couple of seconds. I don't know if too many, most of the Zener diodes you're going to find in like a Radio Shack or someplace local are, you know, milliwatt devices, you know, and even a Transorb, some of those are like 5-watt packages. So I think you can kind of see the problem that I'm saying is that my main advice for, you know, your typical amateur trying to connect up transceivers to batteries and to power supplies are avoid putting in a differential inductor between the transceiver and the power supply. That should just be heavy cable, maybe the differential inductor, the common mode, where you're winding both leads through the core. But I don't think I would ever really advise an amateur, trying to put together their system to put a differential inductor in one of the, like the positive or the negative line between a transceiver and the power supply deck. But there again, I'm kind of a tourist in that area, and I'll leave that one at that. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
When it comes to the Zeners that I can buy at Radio Shack, you're absolutely right. In the industrial world, there are some very beefy Zeners that look like a great big stud rectifier diode. This thing's got a big stud to it. You connect it to a heat sink, and there are Zeners that can take hundreds of watts of dissipation. But this is the commercial and military world. That's not a Radio Shack type Zener. So with Radio Shack Zeners, you're absolutely right. Maybe you could put a few of them in parallel, but even there, you got to worry about how they're really sharing the current. So you're absolutely right. So be careful with Zeners, with series inductors to try to get rid of ripple that's going into mobile rigs. That series inductor, the one nice thing about it is that it does give you some protection from those glitches you can get from an automobile. A conservative guy will turn his rig off when he's operating the starter motor, or if he's got it plugged into a cigarette lighter, which in some cases you can get away with, not always. You unplug it from the cigarette lighter when you're running the starter motor. A conservative guy will not have the rig in the operating mode, even in the receive mode, while the starter motor is running, particularly on a winter day, because some automobiles can put out some wicked voltages as that starter motor is being turned on and off. Lots and lots of current there. There are a few examples of where the locked rotor current into a starter motor can get well above 200 amperes. And the voltage on the battery drops down to some crazy numbers, and when it comes flying back, look out. The protection circuits they have to put into the computer wiring and the front panel wiring of an automobile to protect it from the glitches from that starter motor and the alternator system and so on. There's some wicked currents that happen and crazy spiky voltage that can happen there, even before you get into the ignition circuit. I think we've answered all of the questions of the people who signed in. Let me double check to be sure on that. Have we forgotten anybody by mistake? And Paul, have you thought of your question, WS2N? Let me go to Paul first. And if you've got any...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
If you've got anything you want to tell us about Spaceball, go right ahead and do it now. WS2N, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. No, I didn't have any question. I couldn't come up with anything. As far as the state portion part of the net, there really wasn't much. Just want to mention that Curiosity is still doing well. That's on the way to Mars. It's actually doing some science. It has a radiation detector on board. It's going to be used quite a bit when it's on the planet, but it's actually in use now. It's very deep inside the whole spacecraft right now. It's in a cruise phase. There's a section of the spacecraft that completely separates from the, later on, 6 months from now, and that whole section is very, very deep down in the middle of it is this radiation detector inside the Curiosity. And that's on, and what they do is they detect the particles coming from the sun and future spacecraft, especially manned spacecraft. That could be a problem because they have all kinds of x-rays, secondary x-rays that bounce off the spacecraft, which could be harmful when we drop it. So all this data is collected, and they'll have a good idea of, you know, how much radiation is involved. A manned spacecraft, you would have people in the center, deep down in the middle of the spacecraft, maybe with even, you know, water. You know, you're going to bring water with you. You'll have that in the walls of the spacecraft to try to protect the people on board from cosmic rays. So they're doing their science already on the way to Mars. But one other thing I wanted to mention, there's been a lot of rumors about the Higgs boson, the so-called God particle being discovered in CERN and at the Hadron Collider. I keep looking on the internet over the last 4 or 5 days. I can't find anything to confirm that. A lot of articles you read on the internet saying that they've really discovered that. I haven't found one that said that they really did. I mean, they're looking into it pretty good, but it takes like terabits of information. Let me drop it. From a series of collisions between these different parts that are protons of these atoms to try to evaluate it. I mean, you know, one big blast, which might take a billions of a second, they wind up with terabytes of information that have to be decoded and figured out by these gigantic computers that they have down there. There's no positive answer yet, but they're looking into it. I just want to bring up that. They find that's one of the main goals of this collider that they built down in France and Switzerland. I think it goes between two countries, a 17-mile diameter ring. And that's pretty much it. Back to that WS-20.
Yeah, I did read a couple of the articles about the CERN Large Hadron, LHC, Large Hadron Collider, looking for the Higgs boson. That's the one last missing particle that completes the so-called grand unified theory. The Higgs boson is the one that they think accounts for gravity, if I understand correctly. And they're seeing a hint about the presence. And I think they're coming up with a number of how much energy is required to see it. And I think they pinned it down to the 127 region, greater than 125, but less than 128, something like that. Anyhow, they pinned down the approximate amount of energy that must exist in the particles that are being collided in order to see the hint. And it's two simultaneous experiments. They're two house-size collectors that are in series with each other. One is downrange from the other, and they're both seeing approximately the same amount of this hint. In other words, the particle itself, after it's created, exists for such a short period of time as an independent object that you cannot detect the object, the Higgs boson itself. It only lasts for 10 to the minus 15 seconds or some crazy number. In other words, by the time it leaves the collision environment, let me drop, and is heading for your detector, your house-sized detector that's around the tube, where the vacuum tube where the particle beam goes through. By the time it leaves the collision area, and let me pick a number, it's a quarter of an inch away, it already has lost its property. It's converted to something else. But in the process of being converted to something else, to collide with other particles, and you look at the debris of those collisions and you play it backwards, you can figure out what was the original starting material that started that whole rain of stuff that you do detect. So it's an indirect detection. They've got to do the experiment a zillion times before they'll get the confirmation. And right now they're getting an equal amount of hinting confirmation, this indirect confirmation, out of the two separate detectors. So some of the betting people are saying it will be confirmed. Some of the other people who are super conservative are saying that these guys announced too soon. Well, they're giving you all the caveats. They're saying, this is what we've seen so far. This is our believed judgment at this time. And if at worst they find out that it's wrong, it's not the end of the world. There's a little bit of gamble in everything you do. And the word truth, when it comes to science experiments of this nature, let me drop. The words truth and absolute truth are relative words. They're very subjective words. Today's science truth is not quite as truthful tomorrow when you've got a little bit more information. Hopefully, most of the time, we seek a higher and higher truth. But at no instant of time do you know everything. I mean, the sad state of affairs is occasionally an attorney will have a witness on the stand and say, can you say without a shadow of doubt, blankety, blankety, blank? No matter how they fill in that sentence, the answer always has to be no. There isn't anything. I mean, you think you're hearing my voice. Can you say without a shadow of doubt that you really heard K2RIW at the time? You weren't hearing a recording. You weren't hearing somebody simulating his voice or whatever. There's no way you can be absolutely sure. If you were in the room with me here, you would be a hell of a lot more sure, but you can't be positive. You can't be absolutely sure about anything. So there's a little bit of a gamble in every judgment that you make. And the best you can do is gather the most objective evidence you can. Hopefully the instrumentation is calibrated and the calibration is traceable to the National Bureau of Standards or whatever bureau you've got in your particular country, and therefore the data becomes more and more valid. But nothing is perfect. That's the nature of almost anything along these lines, and certainly of real science. These are some of my beliefs. So I think they're going to confirm it, and the fact that it's so tenuous at this time, I'm not worried. I'd still like to hear what's the latest theory on how in the world those neutrinos appear to be moving 20 parts per million faster than the speed of light. That's still a beautiful experiment. And the fact that it was determined that it was measured both at Fermi Lab and at CERN, two completely separate experiments separated by thousands of miles and years, says that there could be...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
It says that something darn interesting is going on. And neutrinos, as you know, are real tenuous objects. The majority of the neutrinos coming out of the sun pass right through the Earth and don't even hit anything. And on the way between the sun and the Earth, there's three different flavors of neutrinos, and they decide to flip back and forth between the three flavors. That's why Lester Davis, I think his name was, the guy who has this zillion gallons of cleaning fluid in the mine out there in the west, in this great big, is it a gold mine or a silver mine, way underground. He was measuring one-third of the number of neutrinos because his detection technique could only detect one of the flavors of the three different flavors of neutrinos. And on the way from the sun to his detector, they were flipping back and forth between the three different modes, the three different flavors. Life, science is not simple. The universe is not simple. This universe apparently was not designed to be easy for mankind to understand. We're going to be struggling this one for some time to come. So, once again, did I forget anybody who signed in? If so, speak now. K2RIW and the TechNet. Okay. So we've had Mel's Corner, we've had the Space Report, we've answered the first questions. Now we're capable of getting into the really hairy stuff. So Wesley, you mailed me a email of some of the recent test equipment you bought. My goodness, you've got some very good buys there. You've got some slightly older but very well-priced test equipment. You've got quite a few pieces of it. And so I presume that if we saw photographs of your electronic laboratory, it's beginning to look like the photographs that you'll see of John's laboratory. If you go to QRZ.com and you dial in KC2WGB, and you see John's laboratory photographs, you're going to say, wow, that looks like a fun place to work. And I guess, Wes, you're in the process of making something that's going to look similar. Well, we're going to see photographs of yours on QRZ.com one of these days. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2MU. Okay, N2XJN. I think you've seen a part of my lab on the videos, don't you?
Yes, I have. K2MU, did you want to make a statement on some of the previous things that I said? Go ahead.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Quick comment. Just by coincidence, I happen to be watching a documentary called Sputnik Mania, and they mentioned the SCORE satellite. You guys were talking about satellites. Turns out that today, December 18, is the 53rd anniversary of the first communication satellite, SCORE, Signal Communications by Orbiting Relay Equipment, where you probably remember this, Dick, where they put a tape recorder up in an Atlas rocket and had President Eisenhower's voice wishing everybody a good Christmas, the first communication satellite. So it happens to be today, 53 years ago. Just wanted to throw that in there.
If I subtract 53 years from today, what do I come out with? Let's see, roughly 1960 or so, 1959. What's the approximate year on that one, Bernie?
Yeah, 58. It was about a year after Sputnik. So December 18, 1958.
And a small number of years after that, a real serious relaying satellite called Telstar, put up by Bell Laboratories, or is it ITT, was put up. And I remember seeing those live broadcasts for the first time from both Paris and England, London and England. Paris got on the air first, and why can't I think of the famous actor's name who was on live television, transmitted from Paris to the United States to the receiving site in Maine. Can't think of the name of that one right now. They had these hardcore antennas looking at the Telstar satellite. This was the first real satellite where it was actually a repeater in the sky. You transmitted one frequency up to the satellite, and it transmitted another frequency back down. And this was, by modern standards, a low-Earth orbit satellite, because that's all they had boosters for in those days. And I think that was roughly 1960 or 61. Do you happen to remember, Bernie, what was the year of Telstar? K2MU? Another one of our space experts, K2RIW. You got it, Bernie.
Okay, Telstar. I'm just sitting here by the computer here, so let me just check that out. 1962, July 1962. But just to finish up on this, I know you want to pick it up with Leslie there, but just imagine this. They actually put two reel-to-reel tape recorders in the payload, and one of them failed. There was a backup. So what they did was they remotely turned on the tape of the presidential message, and what they were able to do was record a new message as it was flying overhead and then replay it when it was around the globe. So, I mean, with today's technology, you just have to be, you know, amused, I guess, that we actually had to put a tape recorder with reel-to-reel tapes. Compare that to today's technology, it's just amazing. So, 53 years ago today, first communication satellite. Back to you, Dick, K2MU.
In the very early 60s, some of the early satellites being put up were doing surveillance, reconnaissance, taking photographs of various places around the world. And those photographs were going on to film, chemistry-type film, and the film was then being deorbited and collected by a aircraft as it came down on a parachute. Boy, we've come a long way. Now you can make super miniature charge-coupled device cameras, extremely high-resolution photographs. It's all mailed down electronically. You're not sending real film down. I'll bet you a high percentage of the film that they were sending down from those reconnaissance satellites was not properly deorbited or wasn't properly captured. They had all kinds of problems. It was difficult in those days. We've come a long way. And now you can put a camera in something so small that you can't even see it. In fact, there's been a number of news reports recently of people who have gotten themselves in trouble by hiding cameras in funny places where they're violating people's privacy. Okay, so you've collected quite a few more pieces of test equipment, which I think you bought on December 9th. Looks like you bought quite a few of them simultaneously. and some of these slightly older but very well priced. I am guessing you did not buy that electrostatic voltmeter. I'm not sure that you need it, although the first bid price at $45 was sort of interesting. And I'm going to be making some modifications to mine so that I can read higher voltages, but it really is designed to read a steady-state DC high voltage, up to 30 kilovolts, before I do any further converting. Back to you, Wes, N2XJN, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, the reason that I have sent you that list is because I have some questions in green color and a few leads that are attached. The major problem of mine is that I have a need for something like arbitrary waveform generator that is of high voltage. Does not really have to be. It could be also function generator. John has could describe you exactly the waveform that I'm trying to create. I can achieve that waveform from other generators that I have, probably 10 of them. The problem is that I need to memorize or to have that waveform constantly present while I'm sweeping the frequency in order to find that sweet spot for the device that I'm working on it. What I'm trying to do is eliminate doubt that we have, and we discussed last 2 evenings of how much power is being delivered. So what I'm trying to do is eliminate the transformer and just to the Abramenko fork deliver the right voltage at the right frequency. Talking about my lab, let me jump. Well, John lab. Well, I've seen Jablan lab for so many times. I'm a guest in his house. I had that very rare privilege. So thank you, John, for that. And it's impressive. I mean, his lab is impressive. I have a lot of devices. A lot of devices different. Practically, mostly oriented on one single subject, but I could do anything that I want to. As far as the high voltage part, there is something that is being called Stanford Research System, model PS350. That's 5,000 volts, 25 watts. A DC power supply, which is absolutely amazing. When John saw that, he wanted to have the same one, and I talked him to buy it, and he is not sure about it. And then, because that was just a 5,000 volts of DC, he didn't give me any good, so I was hunting for another one, and I was able to low down the price to few bucks from over 2,000. No, it's $2,000, and that is AG0201HV, which is exactly what I'm looking for. It's a high voltage generator that gives me up to 12,000 volts. And John was, as I said in the last segment, very much terrified when I was playing with it. The problem is it gives me only the frequency from 100 kilohertz to approximately 500 kilohertz. So then I had a gap from 0 to 100 kilohertz. I have a master, thanks to Glenn, so I'm going to have a transformer that will give me 1 to 10 ratio, and I would be able to play with it. But I believe one of the best purchases was Laser Metric, model 5046E, which was actually in that image that I have sent you. And I run into the problem here. The device works absolutely, completely beautiful. It gives me over 10,000 volts DC. It does have a various numbers of dials. If you look at the green part of my email, it says in and out delay that the potentiometer pulse width, and I could have the external gating. I could even use the photodiode to trigger it. Everything is okay. So I thought I got finally what I was looking for. The problem is, I have all of these dials. They are useful.
This repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Sorry about this. John, pick up.
Dick, I assume you heard him on the input like I did, right?
So that's 10-4. Yes, I definitely heard everything you said. Go ahead, John.
Okay, the laser metric unit he has a couple of ports on the output. It does produce 10,000 volts, but it goes into a little switch box. There, on the main unit, there are two output PNC connectors, which are the rise, turn on, and fall time, turn off switching that causes this little module to switch back and forth. So what Wesley needs is something he can put that 10,000 volts into and use those driving pulses to switch it on and off. That's what he's looking for. It has a very quick, I think, 1 nanosecond rise time. So it's a very fast switching unit.
I am guessing that the 10,000 volt power supply is capable of issuing some finite amount of current. I'm guessing it was designed to go into a laser-like device. And so would the right kind of a high-power dummy load resistor act as a load so that you confirm, so that you are able to confirm proper operating of rise time and fall time of that 80-50 switching module? Would a load resistor do that? I mean, it sounds a little bit like what they do when they're testing the power supply for a traveling wave tube. A traveling wave tube has got minus 10,000 volts on the cathode. 150 volts away from the minus 10,000 volts is the accelerator voltage on the first accelerator. Some other voltage away from the 10,000 volts is the control grid voltage that turns the beam on and off. The collector is sitting up at plus 5,000 volts. There's an intermediate collector. There's a whole bunch of crazy power supplies, all made for various conditions within the traveling wave tube itself. And most good companies are able to build a network of resistors that substitute for the traveling wave tube so that you can wring out the power supply without damaging a tube until you get all the voltages adjusted right. The nasty thing about a TWT is that before the voltages are adjusted right, the beam is not focused. It would be roaring into the side of the helix and burning it up in a couple of seconds. So a dummy load supply is what they do on TWTs. Do you think, John, it would be possible to build a dummy load supply that would test out this laser power supply switching thing? KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
No, Dick, I don't think so, because in the main unit, he has the power supply for the 10,000 coming out of a port. Then he has all of the gating that turns on this switch box. That's all he has. So he needs to build that actual switch box and use those gate signals. This way he can put his generator into the input port, select the frequency he wants to switch at, then adjust the rise and fall time to trigger this little box. But that box has to be able to handle a little bit above 10,000 volts. That is the... I didn't think he needed that. I thought it was switching the 10,000, and that was just a connection box. This is all for laser operations, obviously. So that's his dilemma. So he needs a switch that he can drive from those two ports. That's basically it.
And the switch is called a 8050. The first link, green underneath of the main one, is actually referring to that one. I gave you all of the literature that I was possibly able to get on it. So that mysterious another box was supposed to get 10,000 volts regulated, BIOS, which is 800 volts, built into the same device, which is the leading edge, and off, which is the trailing edge. And then I wasn't able to find any literature very much on it. So I think you also have leaks from other manufacturers. They make switches and stuff. So just trying to get some information from you.
Okay, I'm slowly understanding now that the 10,000 volt supply you've got there, the commands from that power supply that are made to go into a switching circuit to create the leading edge and trailing edge, you've got the commanding circuitry, but the thing that gets commanded, the real switch, is not there.
That's correct.
Correct. And also I have delay and pause within the same box that I have purchased that can regulate all of the parameters what I need. But I don't have the main small box.
Yeah, whether it either be made out of tubes or made out of solid state, switching on and off 10,000 volts at some number of milliamps of current drain.
1 nanosecond.
Yeah, I've done 1 nanosecond switching, but nowhere near at 10,000 volts. I was switching on and off a signal that went into a traveling wave tube that had 12,000 volts on it, but the 12,000 volts was there steady state. Yeah, switching 10,000 volts, that's not easy. And switching at a 1 nanosecond rate, you're now running into what's called the DVDT problem. When you're trying to switch 10,000 volts down to some lower voltage, let's take the worst case, 10,000 volts down to 0 volts. That's 10 to the 4 volts, and if you did that in 1 nanosecond, which 10 to the minus 9, 10 to the minus 9 times 10 to the 4, and you add the 9 and the 4, we get 13. That's 10 to the 13 volts per second is the DVDT. And that might be beyond the state of the art. In other words, it takes very special circuitry to give you what they call the DVDT problem. What you're trying to do is make extremely small capacitance in order to swing the voltage that fast. So that circuitry, you're not going to buy that at Radio Shack. Maybe not going to be able to buy that at Bell Laboratories in the old days. That's going to be a tough one.
Question, Dick?
Yeah, go ahead, John.
And if he requires a short duty cycle, that even complicates it more, doesn't it?
That doesn't bother me as much. If you're trying to switch 10,000 volts down to something like 0 volts, and you're trying to do it in a nanosecond, I don't think you've got to do it in a nanosecond. In the caduceus coil that he's firing, it is my guess is if he can do it in a small fraction of a microsecond, I think he's going to get the operation he's looking for. But even a microsecond, 10 to the 6 and 10 to the 4 is 10 to the 10. You're looking for 10 to the 10 volts per second of DVDT. I forget what the exact numbers are, but there's a very hard set of numbers of DVDT that are very difficult to exceed. If we start Googling the word DVDT and state of the art, we're eventually going to find out what it is. And 10 to the 10 strikes me as getting awful close to the number that's very hard to get beyond. I mean, if you're trying to make a circuitry that can tolerate the voltage, do the switching, and the circuitry itself only has 10 to the picofarad of capacitance, you got some idea of the conflict of interest we're running into. Over to you first, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Hey, Dick, I know what this device has to be, KC2QIQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Excuse the pun, but a pair of rubber gloves and a 10-inch long knife switch. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, how do you move that knife switch in a microsecond, Glenn?
Nanosecond.
You don't have to, because once you open and close that switch, the rise time will move up and down in a nanosecond, but you're not going to get a rep rate of a nanosecond, that's for sure. KC2QIQ.
Wes, what is making you believe that even though the circuitry that you've purchased, this Lasermetric 5046 Echo, even though it's rated to do its swing in a nanosecond, I'm not convinced that your caduceus coil needs something switching that fast. The ferrite can't move that fast, if you know what I mean. Over to you first, Wes, K2RIW.
Well, what we have experienced in Lithuania, is that we need a very fast rise time of the impulse. Also, there is a very special shape of an impulse, exactly the one that I sent to John, and John would be able to explain that shape. John, pick up.
Wes, you also sent that to Dick, didn't you? Because I don't have that up. I have the coil circuit up on my screen right now. I thought we were going to talk about that. But I think you mailed that same diagram to Dick, didn't you?
No, I did not.
I think you should shoot that right over to him.
Okay, so what I'm going to do is, while we're talking about, I'm going to shoot that diagram, but if you look at the links that I have sent you, all of them in green color, do you see these links? No. It's one only in green links, and the other blue. It says lasermedic.com. Some of the other links that may help. Now, when you go through these links, you're going to see a lot of interesting information. One of the links is not made by laser metrics, but it's fast, high-voltage transistor switches. It's made by Belke, B-E-H-L-K-E, Belke, Belke, right. Then the other one is by Applied Energetics. It's a high-voltage arbitrary waveform generator. Right on the first page, the first page, you see a very simple structure, which is the schematic, exact schematic of the high voltage part of the arbitrary waveform generator. And if you would be able just to say a few words about it, another company that I have sent you makes something like a brick that's Belke. Then some of the products of the laser metric with doesn't sell 8050 block. It just makes me totally confused with how can I solve this problem. And to actually,
even though the laser metrics was designed to switch 10,000 volts in something like a nanosecond, I'm not convinced that your circuit needs that fast a switching speed. However, you might be able to create a kind of a speed up by way of a spark gap. If you design a circuitry that rises in 1 microsecond, and if the microsecond of 10,000 volts is going across a spark gap, at the instant the spark gap starts conducting, internal to the spark gap, if it has a fraction of an inch of length to it, it will generate something like a nanosecond of rise of at least a portion of that waveform. So the spark gap could give you a speed up, and maybe that's part of what the original circuitry is trying to do. So I think the possibility exists that if you switch in a microsecond into a spark gap, you might get what you're looking for. To switch 10,000 volts in a nanosecond, I'm slowly coming to the conclusion that might be beyond the laws of physics. What do you think on this one, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW?
Well, evidently, laser metrics can do it with that added box. So that must be a very sophisticated piece of equipment, I'm sure. And also, I have something to add, a little more information on a discussion we had last week with Wesley's diagram when you get around to that. But I think his best bet is to try to procure that box because there's got to be something very special there.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Before I pick up with Glenn, let me go back to one other statement that just occurred to me, John. Maybe the laser metrics is switching in a nanosecond, but is it switching the whole 10,000 volts? Maybe in a nanosecond, it's making 8,000 volts rise to 10,000. It maybe is only transversing 2,000 volts in the 1 nanosecond. To go the whole 10,000 volts in 1 nanosecond I'm getting skeptical as to whether or not that's possible. But maybe Glenn knows a way. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, I'm just going to elaborate a little bit on what you were saying. Some of the highest speed rectifiers for high voltage, and I'm just going to talk about, let's talk about like a 600 volt device or an 800 volt device. The fastest recovery times on a diode, if you get a transistor or anything else, that you can get a diode to turn on and off, is going to be somewhere in the area of like 35 nanoseconds, and that's less than a kilovolt. If you start stacking rectifiers, let's say if you had kilovolt rectifiers, and you were to stack, let's say, you know, 20 kilovolt rectifiers in series, and you were to just look at the recovery time of those diodes, not excluding any other kind of switching, just a rectifier, the kind of recovery times you could hope for at best are probably going to be somewhere in the area of between 50 and 100 nanoseconds for that structure. Silicon or tubes and their rise and fall times, I don't see just with the mere capacitance and makeup of those devices, the charge in those devices, are going to move anywhere near a nanosecond. Not in from 0 to 100%. I think that's you're beyond the limits of what's technologically possible today in 2011. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Can't be here, guys.
I have a problem with that.
Yeah, Eric, we're going to pick up in a second. I presume I'm going to go back to Glenn for a second first. Glenn, I presume you're already using low-capacitance Schottky diodes. These are intended for very high-frequency switching power supply, and I think you're saying state-of-the-art is kilovolt-type diodes, Schottkys, 35 nanoseconds reverse voltage recovery time. Is that approximately what we're saying, Glenn? Go ahead.
No, not at all, because the Schottky technology, the only reliable Schottky technology I know of right now is about 200 volts, and that's pretty much, you know, state-of-the-art as far as, you know, working technology in a rectifier that will handle any kind of power. In terms of ultra-fast rectifiers, the really fast stuff out there is like, you know, 35 nanoseconds at like, you know, 800 volts. And, you know, you go up from there, it gets a lot slower, a lot faster, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Is that true even of a series stacking of those diodes, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yeah, pretty much. In other words, because what's happening is there's a group delay problem and an energy problem as you start going across the diodes. So you're going to need some kind of like a snubber network to go across the outside of that and tune it for some kind of a rep rate. And let's say even if the rep rate were at like 100 kilohertz, that would be one heck of a job trying to get 10,000 volts going from 0 to 10 kV in even, oh my goodness, 100 recovery time of 100 nanoseconds would be difficult. And like you're saying, even, you know, to have, it's a problem, Dick.
Well, I'm just looking at the spec of Belkin, and it states less than 50 nanoseconds. They make the fast high-voltage transistor switches. You have setting for it. And the applied energetic is even less than that. Then another one, which would be, well, the laser metrics that they put in the spec, regulated from 1 nanosecond to 1.2 microseconds.
Yeah, let's see what Eric's got to say. Eric, you've worked with some pretty fast switching power supplies at pretty high voltages. What do you think is the state-of-the-art in DVDT? KE2EJ, K2RIW. I didn't, but you should wait for the four beeps.
No, I was going to mention that, what Glenn is saying is just sort of there. I mean, I don't see the peak convert recovery time of the diodes is nowhere near that fast. But the only thing that I have in high voltage that works that quickly is my crowbar, which is a deuterium-filled cyclotron. But it's for the reverse. It's go from a non-conducting state to a conducting state, and they guarantee that from the time that the trigger hits it, 6 nanoseconds later, you're taking 30 kilovolts down the ground. So that's pretty damn fast. But I haven't seen anything that operates fast like that, other than trying to get rid of the high voltage. So, and that goes off with a big bang, by the way. And the sad part about it is that the detection circuitry and all the other stuff that drives the cytosine is much slower. C2RIWK2, James.
Wow. 30 kilovolts down to ground in 6 nanoseconds. How many microfarads is that crowbar discharging when it's doing that? Eric, go ahead.
No, you know, you got to remember, we don't need ultra-clean high voltage. We just need clean high voltage. But there's that, there's a one microfarad, there's a one farad, rather, capacitor that sits on the same high voltage line that feeds everything, so... but the actual high voltage supply, which is 160 diodes immersed in mineral oil, you know, with little resistors and chokes across it, all buried in a big whoopee-doo, looks like a big, well, you've seen them, those big things that are outside, they look like power transformers as part of the electric company.
Wow. Now, you said one farad. I'm having great trouble believing that there's one farad at 30 kilovolts. The total number of joules there, 30 kilovolts squared times one farad, it's just out of sight. You're talking about the kind of energy in the beam at CERN. So your crowbar that in 6 nanoseconds brings 30 kilovolts down, that portion of the circuit, is that running one microfarad, not one farad? And even then, 30 kilovolts squared, one-half CV squared, still a lot of energy. Boy, I bet you that thing is noisy. And if that ever falls alarm, my guess is you're awfully unhappy. Over to you, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
No, no, you're right. It's a microfarad. It's not a farad. It's a big capacitor. I mean, if you look at the capacitor size of it, it's not as big as you might think it would be. But oh, by the way, it comes with a big shorting bar when you get it. And, you know, it destroys anything that comes near it. And, yeah, this thing won't fall. So actually, the transmitter circuitry actually gets you three pulses before it fails, because don't forget, most of these things are designed to operate undetended. And, you know, okay, well, maybe you got a little body arc or something like that. So you get three shots before the power supply goes into I ain't crying it no more kind of mode.
If I didn't do the mathematics wrong, 30 kilovolts and 1 microfarad, 1/2 CV squared, 450 megajoules. Are you telling me you dump? That sounds like a lightning bolt. Over to you, Eric.
Actually, when a thing fires up, sounds like a lightning bolt, and the whole room lights up with a big flash. And the darn thing is contained in 6 or 8 inches of ceramic. It's got beryllium seals on it, but it's, you know, solid ceramic. And, yeah, it's very loud.
The actual discharge device, it's a cyrotron. I think you said it's 6 inches in diameter, ceramic. How tall is it? And the contacts on it must be like 3 inches in diameter to take those kind of currents. I could calculate the current, and it's a huge number. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, if I can remember, the next time I look in the book, they actually give the number. It's a huge number. The contact ring on the cyclotron, maybe about, it goes around the outside diameter of the tube. Each one of those rings is about, I think, 2 or 3 inches wide and 2 or 3 inches thick. And, yeah, it's not that long, but it's nasty. And, yeah, it's filled with deuterium, you know, and heavy hydrogen.
I'm guessing the whole reason for your crowbar circuit is to first detect that an arc that takes place in your very valuable amplifying tube, an arc in that tube, and this amount of current and that many megajoules of energy in your storage capacitor at 30 kilovolts would be splattering metal all over that beautiful vacuum inside the tube and damage the daylights out of it. So I presume at the beginning of an arc,
Your circuitry is supposed to detect the beginning of the arc and as fast as possible discharge all of the stored energy in your power supply filter capacitor to 1 microfarad at 30 kilovolts. Discharge it as fast as possible to minimize the discharge energy that's delivered inside of the vacuum tube that's the high power amplifier. Is that approximately the same, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW?
That's not approximately, that's precisely. Actually, the part that you left out is that there's various different kinds of detection, including an optical detection looking for a spark or a body current arc. And it also shuts the primary side of the power supply down, too, at the same time. Got to remember, the big power supply actually doesn't have any real filtering in it. The filtering is external and it's kind of minor. It's not perfect DC, but it's close to it.
So that arc detecting circuitry and that crowbar circuit is there to protect your very valuable amplifying tube. The tube is protecting. What's that tube worth? $50,000, rough number. Over to you, Eric.
It's about $37,000. And they're fun to replace, but you really don't want to be doing that too often. You're supposed to get about $40,000 to $60,000 out of it, too.
Now, has that circuitry ever false alarmed? In other words, you've seen it discharge, and I'm guessing that is a test procedure that you went through. Has that circuitry on you ever false alarmed? And if so, what created the false alarm? Or did it really do a crowbar protection, and therefore it saved your tooth? Tell me about the times that it did occur. Over to you, Eric.
Okay. Actually, there's a number of times when the thing failed. And a lot of times the detection circuitry itself failed. You got to remember that the detection circuitry itself sits at, now you got to remember that most of this stuff is below ground, so the tube operates at minus 28,000 volts. The actual control circuitry operates at minus 27,993 volts. So it's sitting floating in that high voltage gauge there, so that can make a lot of fun in terms of trying to troubleshoot the actual way the control signals and the command signals get to it through a piece of fiber optic for obvious reasons. And sometimes you have some bad components in the detection circuitry, or sometimes you'll get other kinds of problems where the tube will begin to arc over. You have a bad visual happening for some reason, like if you lose nitrogen or air pressure in the line, and you get a little bit of an arc over. We've had loose bolts on the 6-inch coax that goes up to power. Things like that will fire it off. But the stuff is the detection circuitry is pretty sensitive. Let me drop. And it doesn't take much for it to fire, but there's been a number of times where it really saves your neck and protects your tube. I'll give you one example. When they came to put a digital signal on the analog portion of the transmitter when the transmitter was operating analog, and they overdrove the damn thing, and that will cause their power supply breakdown between the grid and the accelerators in the tube, and thank goodness for the crowbar protecting the tubes rather than blowing it up, although they actually did blow up a tube, and the company that was doing that particular thing had to eat the cost of a tube. So, but most of the time, it's either the detection equipment or the bias supply screws up, and you've got to replace it. Particular manufacturer has the crowbar circuitry is in one kind of housing, which is mounted in the high voltage cage. The bias supply and the ion supply and the filament voltage supply is another thing, which they call the toaster because it kind of looks like a toaster. It sits on four of insulated pieces of phenolics, and that also sits in the high voltage cage. And now you get the idea. K2RIW, K2JN.
When you're running at 28 kilovolts, if by mistake in your air cooling system, if it's air cooled, maybe it's fluid cooled, but if it's an air cooling system and a whisker of lint or a whisker of dust gets in the wrong place, and the 28 kilovolts arcs across the